Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The House passes a bill from Liz Cheney to reform the counting of electoral votes and help prevent a repeat of the January 6th riot. What will this legislation do, and why has it taken Congress so long to get here? Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, columnist Kim Strassel and editorial board member Mene Ukwe-Barua. Welcome to you both. The Presidential Election Reform Act is the House version of this bill. It's 38 pages long and was introduced last week by Liz Cheney and Democrat Zoe Lofgren. And it substantially updates the 1887 Electoral Count Act that currently governs the January 6th session of Congress. Let's listen to a clip from Liz Cheney on the House floor explaining pieces of what this bill would do.
Our bill reaffirms what the Constitution and existing law make plain. The Vice President has no authority or discretion to reject official state electoral slates. It also makes clear that if members of Congress have any right to object to electoral slates, those grounds are limited to the explicit constitutional requirements for candidate and elector eligibility in the 12th Amendment's explicit requirements for elector balloting.
So this bill has now passed the House with lightning speed last week. The vote was 229 to 203, with 9 Republicans voting yes. And there's a Senate companion bill that is a little different in some respects. Maybe the way to go is just to break down the proposals one by one. And to start with where Liz Cheney started in that clip, the House bill says the role of the presiding officer is ministerial on January 6th. And that means, Kim, this is clearly responding to President Trump's argument after the 2020 election that Vice President Mike Pence, as the presiding officer of the January 6th session, could throw out electors or maybe call the whole thing into recess for states to make some investigations or whatever he wanted them to do.
Correct. And that obviously was an enormous catalyst or part of the reason why we had the January 6th riot, in that Donald Trump had been amping up the pressure on Pence for weeks to act. A lot of the people that were marching down and attempted to get in were angry over Pence's refusal to do that. As we have written a number of times, we feel he saved the day by somewhat bravely bucking that pressure and acting in a ministerial fashion. Now, this particular legislation would clarify that, make clear that the vice president really only has one role, which is to preside over an act that is already laid out, ministerial, obviously. Now, one thing just to point out, there is a little bit of lack of clarity in the 12th Amendment about the actual role here, and that can't be fixed by a statute like this. But it would nonetheless, I think, be very important to simply have Congress lay out its own version of the explicit procedure and the guardrails, including the role of the vice president, to try to tamp down on that ambiguity going forward, at least or until at some point, if it were to happen, we had more court guidance on that 12th Amendment provision.
I think that's a good point on the 12th Amendment, because that was, if you read the John Eastman memos that were floating around in Trump world prior to the January 6th session, that's a lot of what it was about. And the key sentence of the 12th Amendment is that the vice president shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all the certificates, and the votes shall then be counted. And so the argument of Trump world or John Eastman was that that means the vice president is the one who is doing the counting of the votes and can choose which ones to count and which ones not to count. Or at the very least, he's in charge of this joint session. The opposite argument was, look at the language of the 12th 12th Amendment. It says the votes shall then be counted. That's in passive voice. That does not give the vice president as the presiding officer the authority to choose what to count and what not to count. But Monet, to the point that Kim was making, I agree that even if we can't get rid of that lack of clarity in the 12th Amendment by passing a law, it would be helpful to the next Mike Pence, who's the next person sitting in that chair, to have it say in statute, to have it say explicitly in Congress's own laying out of its procedures for the January 6th session that the presiding officer's role is basically to preside and not to make any substantive decisions on his own.
Yeah, that's right. I think it gets to the conversation that we have again and again about Congress's responsibility to create the law and the trend in recent years of them deferring that responsibility to judges. And what we have in these Electoral Count Act reform bills is basically Congress stepping up and saying, we are going to refine the definition of this old statute, which has been problematic, instead of it leaving it in the hands of a judge to determine whether the vice president has the responsibility to actually intervene in the count. We are going to say we are interpreting the vision of the founders, who almost certainly did not intend sort of for the vice president to be able to intervene in a political process of this kind. And we're going to put sort of very definitive guardrails on their ability to potentially choose to intervene. I do agree with Kim that ultimately they can't change sort of the constitutionally allotted vice presidential role. And so theoretically, that provision could be subject to a lawsuit. But it seems as if, even though it hasn't been litigated in the past, the prevailing sort of judicial reasoning has been that the vice president can't have this authority. And it's very politically helpful for Congress to come in and say that they agree with that prevailing sort of legal theory.
Another piece of this that I think is important is giving some certainty to which slate of electors coming from a state is treated as conclusive. And some of this goes back to, just to redo some of the history, we're talking about the 1887 Electoral Count Act, and that was passed after the contested 1876 election. And one of the problems there was that you had competing slates of electors. So the governor of Oregon certified one slate of electors. The secretary of state of Oregon certified a different slate of electors. So those both get passed on to Washington, D.C. and ultimately to Congress. And Congress is faced with this choice of what do we do in this situation where we have competing electors from one state. And the way that the House bill and also the Senate bill, though the language is a little bit different, would deal with that is to say, if we have a slate of electors that is signed or has been submitted by the governor of that state, we are going to treat that as conclusive. And so if there is a rogue official in the Secretary of State's office or something like that, you know, they can sign whatever they want. They can send it into Washington, but it's not going to be treated as if it is real. And Kim, I think that is an important clarification and not something really responsive to what happened in 2020, but certainly you can imagine a situation where there's a disputed outcome in a state and you have, you know, in some states, the Secretary of State is appointed, in some states it's elected. So you may have a state where there's a Republican governor and a Democratic Secretary of State or vice versa. And so I think it would be a great improvement to have Congress putting into law, here's what we're going to take. If we get electors sent in by a governor, we're going to treat them as the real ones.
If there's one thing we learned throughout this whole process is never underestimate the way that creative election officials or people that are on the losing side of an election may come up with thoughts or schemes of how they can try to affect a different result. So you're right, Kyle, even though this was not something that was prominent, the heavy discussions about slates of electors and the efforts on the ground in some places to try to gin up some alternate states of electors have certainly made the people who were writing these bills in both the House and the Senate cognizant of the risk of that happening in the future. The other part of this, though, that I do think is very, very important is that you also don't want a situation in which there are some legitimate questions about the outcome of the votes and the election, and yet this rush at the state level to move ahead. And so this also does give participants in elections the right to go to the federal courts and litigate to a certain extent certain questions about this. Or for instance, as you said, if a rogue governor refused to actually certify the real winner, at least as that defined by the state's laws governing elections in the state legislature, someone could could appeal to a federal court, and that court would then have the power to direct another official to be the one that submitted the official slate. And this particular provision also pushes back the date at which electors have to vote now to December 23rd, which is specifically to allow more time for those kind of challenges to play out. So it provides both a forum for having any disputes settled, but also great clarity about who is meant to be submitting the final slate of electors.
And then we get to Congress's role in this. And under the current Electoral Count Act, here's how it works. The presiding officer, the tellers, as they're called, they read out the electors state by state, and Congress can object to them. And what happens right now is an objection requires only one member of the House and one member of the Senate to have signed it. And then both chambers are required to break for debate to hear the objection. And the objections don't need to be specific. They can be in any vague language. And so that's why we've seen objections about Russian interference, allegedly, in the 2016 election. We saw objections about Ohio voting machines in 2004. We saw objections about Florida in 2000. But that isn't really supposed to be Congress's role to second guess, you know, the counting, the disputes, electoral disputes that happen at the local and state level. And so the first thing that this Cheney bill would do is it would raise the threshold for objections. In order to be debated, an objection would need one-third support from the House and one-third support from the Senate. And that differs a little bit from the Senate bill, which doesn't go quite as high. That would be one-fifth support in the House and one-fifth support in the Senate. And Manet, I guess I wouldn't, this is not the hill I would die on in terms of the exact fraction of what you would need, but it certainly seems like it's an improvement to me to require some consensus of a significant chunk of Congress that there's something wrong before they're going to start actually debating whether or not to throw out these electors. Because if the threshold is currently one member of the House and one member of the Senate, you can probably find one member on either side of Congress to agree with just about anything.
Right. I do think that the difference between the House and Senate bills, whether they require one-third or one-fifth of the body to object, is not super material. It seems to be in the right neighborhood in the sense that you want it to be able to be done by a single party. If there were theoretically some real malfeasance and you wanted to have sort of a Congress as a backstop on the sort of certification of fraudulent electors, you'd want to have a threshold that wasn't so high that theoretically the party in power would be able to completely steamroll the minority. Especially in this day and age, you're never going to get representation below one-fifth or one-third in either House of Congress. And so it still leaves open that avenue for the extraordinary cases. But generally, I agree with you that the threshold certainly is way too low now. Obviously, the incentives for everyone in Congress are to basically just grab the limelight by mounting some kind of frivolous objection to electors when the opposite party has won the election. This has become very famous in the past election cycle because of the events of January 6th, but I think it's important to point out that this has been a bipartisan phenomenon going back years, that the losing party generally has lots of representatives challenging electors and basically taking center stage on the floor to be able to speechify about whatever their sort of, you know, trumped up concerns might be. So yeah, I think we're going to see some consensus between the House and Senate about what the threshold should be, but everyone should be in favor of lifting it and making it much harder to have these frivolous objections.
Hang tight, we'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
Your Money Briefing will explore what you need to know to become a homeowner and how to sustain your home by learning ways to manage the costs from unexpected expenses.
You're basically always in a state of checking. You're always keeping your eye open for anything that could be going wrong with your house. Your house is a complicated machine. It has a lot of systems and components in it, and those systems and components are getting older, they're wearing out.
You can get early access to our series, Buying a Home and Keeping It, on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. The other piece of this House bill that is intriguing to me and looks like it might be an improvement on the Senate bill is the substance of the objections. And so the Senate bill would continue to allow Congress to object that a given slate of electors was not, quote unquote, regularly given. And this is a term of art. This is the kind of thing that you saw being floated after the 2004 election, after 2016. And the House bill, I think, maybe makes an improvement by doing away with that and saying that if a third of Congress wants to object to some slate of electors, then they have to give their reason up front. We're not going to let them object in vague, nebulous terms and then break to debate it and give it that legitimacy. We're going to make you put it in writing in front. And so there's a specified set of complaints in this House bill. So if there's electors from a state that is not legitimately a state when the election was held, if a state sends too many electors, if electors vote on the wrong day, or if the electors are ineligible, if the president or the vice presidential candidate is ineligible. And so, Kim, the great advantage of that, in my mind, is that you can't get up and complain about the voting machines in whatever state. You have to have a specified reason in the law for objecting. And these are relatively narrow categories.
Right. And I think the way to look at this is, for those of us who have been critical of the Electoral Count Act, we've called for its full repeal. Our argument has been that Congress really shouldn't be able to stick its grubby fingers into questions of state elections, especially when procedures and state law have been followed. And yet we've seen this growing tendency of them to do that. So if you're not going to get rid of the act overall, my preference is obviously more along the lines of this, where you are not only raising the threshold for the amount of people in Congress you need to lodge an objection, but to limit those objections to things that have to do with grave issues of procedure, or as Liz Cheney said, things that are problematic as written into the Constitution. And you just outlined some of those. Now, I would point out that this in no way robs any candidate running for federal office, the president or the vice president, a team of them, from, again, engaging in some sort of litigation at a state level, whether in state courts over the way that the election went down, whether or not the ballot machines had a problem, whether or not the legislature chose the electors in the appropriate way. There are still opportunities for that to happen at the state level before certain deadlines and before governors then submit their slate. It just means that after the fact, Congress can't stand up and still be nursing grievances about this or that and engage in further delay or problems with the Electoral Count Act on issues outside of these very limited situations.
And that doesn't mean that there's no room for congressional shenanigans to take place. I mean, I can think of a couple of examples. One is that there were people who argued that John McCain was not eligible to be president even after he was nominated because he was born in the Panama Canal Zone. There are people who make a similar argument about Ted Cruz because he was born in Canada. And the other one that comes to mind is the 14th Amendment. There are people who say that the January 6th riot qualifies as an insurrection as defined under the 14th Amendment. And so people who took part in it or encouraged it are disqualified from holding offices in the United States. And that may include President Trump, as the argument goes. And so even if Congress retains the ability under this Cheney bill to adjudicate those kinds of issues, whether a candidate for president or vice president is eligible or ineligible, you can still imagine some real political fireworks taking place. And Manet, I guess my hope is that anything like that would be litigated and settled long before January 6th. I mean, maybe there's a way for a lawsuit to come up in the course of a presidential campaign, whether somebody gets ballot access, whether their name gets put on the ballot. But it strikes me as a little bit late on January 6th. That's 2 months after the election. That's 14 days before the transfer of power from one president to the next is supposed to take place. It seems to me that is a little late for Congress to be waddling in and saying, well, we think this candidate is disqualified, and so we're going to throw out his presidential electors. I think that would be an explosive moment in the country.
Yeah, we should certainly hope that one of the many touch points along the sort of American federal election system would serve to settle the question of the president's eligibility long before 2 months after the election, sort of right before the president is supposed to be inaugurated. And I think that when it concerns certain qualifications, like the age of the president or whether the president is a natural born citizen, it would be a clear-cut issue. There's no chance that you would ever have any ambiguity about that. If somebody who didn't meet that qualification was to seek the presidency, they would be challenged and the court would rule definitively on it long before the certification of the electors. But I do think with regard to the insurrection provision, and again, this is referring to the 14th Amendment disqualification of anyone who has participated in an insurrection from holding public office, there actually could be some ambiguity that would be difficult for courts to resolve. I think that the definition of what it means to take part in an insurrection is not something that is legally clear-cut. And so certainly if Trump were to run again, you would have lawsuits alleging that he'd taken part in an insurrection. But I could certainly see a scenario where judges would be a little bit timid about ruling definitively on that and say that this is a political question. So that leaves open the possibility that Congress would have to kind of step in and rule on that, that sort of Democrats would allege that Trump is ineligible despite him having been elected. Again, it's extremely unlikely, but I do think that that is a possibility. And so you can make an argument in that case for giving Congress the right to make a judgment on that question in the same way that Congress makes a judgment on what high crimes and misdemeanors mean in the case of impeachment. It is somewhat of a political question at the end of the day.
Kim, my final thought here is I'm not sure that this House bill is a perfect bill. I'm not sure the Senate bill is a perfect bill, but I think both are better than the status quo that we have. You know, for example, I've seen some criticism of the House bill that the cause of action allowing presidential and vice presidential candidates to sue might be a little bit too broad. It says any candidate may sue who appears on the ballot. And so I've seen criticisms that you can imagine third parties who get a fraction of the vote, a Jill Stein or someone like that, filing lawsuits everywhere because they have grievances with how some piece of the election was run, even though they're not really in competition to win the election in the first place. And so maybe there are some issues between the House and the Senate that they can hash out. But do you think that now that we have a House passed bill, do you think that that raises pressure on the Senate to get that done or to pass their own bill and get to a conference committee? And I guess my last thought is here, why did this take so long? I mean, we're now almost 2 years from January 6th, and to me, this was one of the obvious things to do in the wake of it.
Yeah, well, one reason it took so long is because it was not a Democratic priority, which is really odd if you think about it. I mean, on the one hand, all they wanted to do was talk about January 6th, but it turns out they wanted to talk about it in a political fashion or in a way that promoted their own agenda. And so instead of talking about reform of the Electoral Count Act, which is the obvious source of the problem here, they wanted to use all this as an excuse to push along a bill that would result in their own federal takeover of state voting laws. And that was a driving priority for quite some time. Obviously, they also were more focused on President Biden's COVID bill and then infrastructure. And so the whole thing was a bit bizarre and I think really undermined the credibility of Democrats who claimed that this was such a key moment in the United States and its history that they wouldn't even move more quickly to deal with it. Now, even now, it was interesting, as you said in the opening, there were 9 Republicans who voted for this. Most of those 9 were those who had also voted to impeach Donald Trump after January 6th. I think that there would have been a great deal more support among Republicans for this were it not for the name at the top of the bill, which was Liz Cheney. She has really riled most of her Republican colleagues, and that alone, regardless of the merit or the substance of a bill, seemed to be enough to put off some more Republicans from taking part of it. This should add to some pressure for the Senate to act, but as usual, here's the problem, is that we are running out of time. The Senate and the House are in session really only for the rest of this week, and only a partial week given the Rosh Hashanah holiday. They've got to get a continuing resolution done in order to keep the government lights on. And then they are all eager to rush out of town and go back back and campaign. There's a possibility that this could maybe come up in the lame duck after the election is over. But again, time is just growing short.
Thank you, Kim and Manet. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button. And we will be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.